Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that were so successful off-Broadway that they just had to transfer to the Great White Way and try some luck over there. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of all the Broadway podcast hosts, and with me today is another BPN host. He's got his podcast with BPN, Little Me, Growing Up Broadway. He's also been a guest on this podcast many years ago. Please welcome back Mark Tumanelli.
Many years.
Like a year, but in my mind, it's been like, in my mind, I've known you for 9 years, but that's simply not true.
Well, it does feel that way, doesn't it, Matt?
Knowing me just makes life seem a lot longer, don't it?
No, it feels great. Knowing you has changed my world.
That's so sweet. It's a lie, but he's on my podcast, so he's got to say nice things.
Why people do my podcast all the time and they don't say nice things. So there you go.
Well, you get people like Andrea McArdle, and she's probably just like, what? So what? Who cares? So
she's,
what?
She's the greatest. She smoked an e-cigarette the whole time.
What we do when we're an icon. Speaking of Andrea McArdle, she did a regional production of this show. Mark, what show are we talking about today?
We're talking about You're in Town.
Your ticket should say You're in Town. Yes, we're talking about Urinetown, book by Greg Kotis, music by Mark Holman, and lyrics by both gentlemen. Mark, what is your history with this show?
Great. I was a 20-year-old, maybe I turned 21, when this show was in previews. I saw it. I was obsessed with it. And then 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. And I still lived in New York, obviously. And so there was this initiative in New York City where it was, if you spent $100 in New York City on anything, groceries, eating out at a restaurant, you could bring your receipts to New York and Company, and they would give you 2 tickets to any Broadway show. Mm. And I did that for You're in Town like 4 times. So I saw You're in Town a lot in the months post 9/11. And it's like musical comedy perfection to me. So I have a great love for the show, and I have never seen it again. I've never seen a regional production. I've never seen a high school production. I've never directed it. I've never been in it, but I have a great love of that original Broadway cast and production.
I feel like you should stage at some point. I feel like that's a show for you to direct.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I am on hold, and I've been on hold for several weeks. I think we're at 8 weeks with the MTI, who will not give me the rights to do this musical. So I sent an email to Greg last night and said, I would like to do You're in Town as our first show back at Broadway Workshop for our main stage. And what I got is radio silence so far.
What's he so damn busy with?
I don't know, but I would love to do it. And it very well be my main stage as long as they make that decision in the next 5 days because I got to announce something.
Absolutely. Well, I'm fingers crossed for you. You will know in the next 5 days by the time that this episode comes out. But as we're recording, we don't know. I have only seen amateur productions of Year in Town. I did not see it on Broadway, unfortunately. This was the season that I was really into Millie. And I was into
Of course you were.
I was a baby. Okay. It's just,
I loved Millie so much, but I always like the underdog show, and Year in Town's the underdog show.
I usually am the underdog person. I just didn't know much about Year in Town. It was right before I was about to start going to school in the city. I think if I had been going to school in the city at that point, I would have gone to see it. Because it was just so around everywhere, but it was there for my first 2 years at PCS. And I remember seeing ads all the time, and it would say Year in Town, and they would, underneath the title, they would phonetically spell out how it's pronounced, and then there'd be like little scribbles like, is that really the title of the show, and blah blah blah. And the only person in my family who had seen it was my grandmother, and she did not care for it, so everyone else in my family was like, oh, we won't see it then. And then I saw the Tony performance, and I thought it looked really cool. But when you're, you know, 12, 13 years old, you're really kind of at the whim of the people who pay for the tickets. So I was not a loud enough voice to get anyone to go with me. And then it closed. And I remember the older theater kids around me were so into it, and they would sort of talk about moments in the show that they loved. Like, I have a very distinct memory of Skylar Astin, then Lipstein, reenacting Officer Lockstock's slow-mo run at the end of Act One, for me and a bunch of other people, because he had just seen the show, and he was talking about like just how funny it was. And I was like, that does sound really funny. I wish I had seen it. So I finally did get to see it at Everyone Take a Shot, Stage Door Manor. And then I saw it at two other schools and in regional production, and finally got my hands on the bootleg that's now on YouTube. And I went, oh, right. This is how good the show can be.
There's a very comprehensive original cast bootleg that I watched last night in prep for this. And it was so nice to revisit old Year in Town.
Old Year in Town. It is a very wonderful bootleg. And it's early enough in previews. It's like about 2 weeks before 9/11 happens. But it's the show is set at that point. They didn't really make any major changes after this bootleg happened.
And the audience is like dying over themselves. It's very rare that there's real musical comedy where it's like there's a joke every 3 seconds.
Yes.
And Year in Town delivers that in a way that very few shows can, which is why I think I have a great affinity for the book and the score, and you know, these brilliant people who brought these characters to life.
Yeah. Well, it's also a very tricky show in a lot of ways, because it is satirical, and it's a send up of the tropes of musical theater while still adhering to the structure of it all. And I think a lot of people, you're very lucky you never saw a school or amateur or regional production of it, because all the non-Broadway productions I've seen, it's not that they don't trust the material, it's that they go too broad.
Yeah.
And I was in my research, the thing that all the actors from the original production talk about is that, you know, like the first day of rehearsal, John Rando, the director, said, treat this like you're in an episode of Law and Order. It's very serious, and it's, you know, very earnest. Don't ever wink at the audience. Don't ever mug. Don't ever act like you're smarter than the material. It's so, because it's such an odd show, and what the characters say are so odd, and you have, you know, Officer Lockstock breaking the fourth wall all the time and talking about conceits in musical theater. The only way it works is if you play it straight. And when you watch the bootleg of the original production, that is exactly.
I mean, they are doing Medea. So fun, because, and that's why the audience is laughing so hard. Yeah. I mean, when they're saying, my favorite joke in the show, and I don't know if that's like a question we'll get to. And I was remembering last night, I was like, is it coming? Is it coming? And it's, she goes, when can I see you again? And he goes, my dear, in this light, you can't see me at all. Mm-hmm. Or in this darkness, you can't see me at all. And I'm like, that is exactly what I think is funny. Mm-hmm. And as a kid who grew up obsessed with Airplane, that movie and Spaceballs, like those two movies are my comedy North Stars. And Year in Town was that on stage. Like every joke is self-aware without the actor ever being. And if you go back and watch Airplane, which I suggest people do every 6 months, just to remember that things can be funny, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, it's like all of those jokes, you know, there's trouble in the cockpit. What is it? It's a small room in the front of the plane, but that's not important right now. Mm-hmm. That to me is what a joke is.
It's so good. Airplane is such a perfect parallel to this. I was reading the New York Times review for it, and they were like, it's Three Penny Opera by way of South Park. And I think that's also very accurate, because when you watch a good episode of South Park, what makes it so funny is all the voice acting is still very serious. The way Randy will go, Shelly! Like, it's just so over dramatic and intense. And I'm thinking of Airplane and not Julie Haggerty, but the other stewardess who she's so scared, and I'm 23 and I've never been married. And one of the passengers comes up and says to the doctor, like, any idea what's going on? No, how are you doing? To be honest, I've never been so scared in my life, but at least I have a husband. And the steward just breaks down and sobs, like so fully good. Crying tears in her eyes. And it's brilliant.
It's a perfect film.
It is a perfect film. And You're in Town is pretty perfectly structured as well. The interesting thing about it is neither writer has really done much since this show, at least nothing in New York that we've been able to see. I know that they're both based in Chicago, but there was talk of them doing other stuff. They were supposed to do a musical version of The Man in the White Suit, which is a British sci-fi satire film. That went nowhere. And then they were going to make a trilogy out of Urinetown. They were going to do a prequel called Yeast Nation, which had a production.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Yeah.
And Harriet Harris and my friend Joy Soprano was in that.
It got good reviews. They did anything in San Francisco and Chicago. I don't know if they ever did it here, but
they did it here, I think, in the Fringe or the Musical Theater Festival or something like that.
Yeah, they did it at the Fringe again. And the response was solid, but nothing came of it. And then they never, maybe they did write the third part, but no one's ever heard of it. But yeah, it's frustrating because it's such a good show and they are good writers, and I wish that we would hear more from them. But it's interesting we say The Fringe, because that is how this show came to be. This is the off that leads to the off that leads to the Broadway,
and that's what this series is all about.
That's exactly what it's about. It's all from in a great way. Yeah, the origin of this piece. Well, actually, first of all, Mark, for those who don't know, what is Urinetown about?
Urinetown is about a Gotham-like city that has a severe water shortage. Water shortage. And so all of the people have to pay to use the public bathroom. And so it's really a story about haves and haves nots, the upstairs, downstairs of it all. And these rich people who are making these decisions and these poor people who are kind of coming together to figure out how they're going to pay to pee, and the uprising that comes out of that. And of course, there's a love story between the guy who's in charge of choosing this pay to pee thing and the guy who's leading the revolution and this guy's daughter. You know, that was, can I start over? There's a
Please
lot that
start
goes on.
Over.
There's a lot that goes on. It is a musical about people having to pay to pee, and we are not that far off from that at any time here in America.
No.
And so I think the show feels so relevant. I love when people are like, I'm doing cabaret, it's more relevant than ever. I'm like, all right, we got it. It'll never not be relevant.
It's never not going to be relevant.
It's sort of that thing. Do you want me to read a description?
Yeah, read some description, because left to your own devices, you're not going to help anyone.
You can just suck it. The description here on Wikipedia is really bad. So I'm looking for a better description for you.
Okay.
Oh my God. All right. It satirizes the legal system, capitalism, social irresponsibility, bureaucracy, corporate mismanagement, and municipal policies. The show also parodies the musical Three Penny Opera, The Cradle of Rock, Les Mis, and the Broadway musical itself as a form. So let's just go with that.
Yeah. The main characters, we've got Bobby Strong, who helps Pennywise, Miss Pennywise, is that
the clown from It?
Yeah, the clown from It. Imagine if the clown from It were a character in Urinetown. Bobby Strong helps regulate and takes fees from the worst part of town that at their public amenity, and his father gets carted off. Oh, so the other thing is, it's called Urinetown.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! You are not better at this than I am.
I am not better. I am perpendicular. But It's the reason why it is called Urinetown. So everyone has to pay to use the their restrooms because of this drought that's been going on for 30 years. And there is a major company that's in charge of all the fees called Urine Good Company. And if you do not have a lot of funds, then you have to, you have to go to the worst part of town to be able to pay for the toilet. And if you don't pay, if you choose to go into the bushes or something, you are carted off by the authorities to what is called Urinetown. And the joke, part of the joke of the show is that no one ever knows what Urinetown is. It's always referred to on the sly. You know, the police officers take people away and then you never hear about it ever again. But because this show breaks the fourth wall and because Officer Lockstock is the narrator of it, we do find out what Urinetown is pretty early on. Just the rest of the cast does not until Act Two. And that's one of my favorite jokes in the show. Basically, anytime Officer Lockstock speaks, I am guffawing. And he enters and mentions Urinetown. Welcome to Urinetown. Not the place, of course, the musical. Urinetown, the place. Well, it's a bad place. A place you won't hear about until Act Two. And, well, let's just say it's filled with symbolism and things like that. And everyone's always talking about it. Bobby's father breaks the law and pees himself because he can't afford the fee that day. And they cart him off to Urinetown. And this haunts Bobby. And this is ultimately what inspires him to start the revolution, to rebel against Urine Good Company and have everyone pee for free. And he just so happens to fall in love on site with the daughter of Caldwell B. Cladwell, the man who owns Urine Good Company and is in charge of all the fee hikes. And there's character. I thought that was solid. That was actually pretty solid.
Also, I don't think anyone's listening to this who doesn't know Urinetown.
You don't know. You never, ever know.
Don't know Urinetown, take a moment, watch the bootleg, and then pick back up
and
right
then pick
here
back up right up from, yeah,
at minute whatever we're at.
Minute 9,000. I had to do a Q&A event that was Hamilton themed with actors from Hamilton. And we were talking about the show. And the liaison
about Urinetown.
No, about Hamilton. And the liaison for this event from the company that we were, you know, doing this for, she asked me on the side, can you do a brief plot description of Hamilton for people who don't know? And I said to her, everyone's here for a Hamilton event. I assumed everyone knew what Hamilton was. Like, if everyone requested it, isn't it because they know it? She's like, well, some people might have shown up just to do something today. I was like, what is your company? What are people? So, yes,
talk about that. You work there.
I don't work there. I worked there for that day. Let's take Mark's side on this, guys. If you don't know Urinetown that well, you can take our terrible, terrible summaries and then
I stand by my summary. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, someone's got to. So pause.
We're having fun.
Watch the absolutely perfect bootleg and then come back and listen to us talk about it. I also love everything with Lockstock and Little Sally, the side character Little Sally, who is like a street urchin, like street kid, latchkey kid kind of person. And they're always sort of talking about the structure of the show as well as the politics that's going on in it. And the two things I really love are when Little Sally mentions hydraulics. We don't talk about hydraulics all that much, do we? And he explains to her how musicals work, like how a parent would talk about how babies are made. You see Little Sally sometimes in a musical. And then when she asks about Urinetown, she asks like, is it scary or something? And he says, I can't tell you about it, Little Sally. We're too early in the show. I can't just, you know, blurt out, there is no Urinetown. We just kill people. No, I can't do that. And it's such a wonderful moment because you watch Spencer Caden in the bootleg and she definitely registers what Officer Lockstock has just said. But because of how the musical needs to work, she pretty much forgets about it pretty quickly. But you definitely watch Buster Kanan's face when Jeff McCarthy just fucking blurts out, there is no Urinetown, we just kill people.
Can we talk about Spencer Caden for 30 seconds while
we can talk
there
about every single original cast member for 45 seconds?
Okay, well, Spencer Caden gave one of the greatest comedic female performances I've ever seen on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I was such, like, I just rooted for her so much that year and that Tony season. And also, like, I remember some quote she said, like, 6 months ago, I was working at a desk job and now I'm nominated for a Tony Award. Mm-hmm. And as someone who was working at a desk job, and that's all like I wanted to do at the time, I found her very inspiring. Of course, she didn't do a whole lot after, and neither did I. So, you know, but in the moment, boy, was I, you know, rooting for that girl and her brilliant, brilliant performance in the show. She was on Broadway again in a show at the Roundabout a few seasons later. Yeah,
Don't Dress for Dinner, which she was nominated for a Tony again. She does a lot of voice work. I looked up because good. I also was sad that she didn't come out to Broadway.
I only want the best for Spencer Caden. I'm checking on her wiki. Oh,
she's married to Mark Harlick.
And she's much older than I had any idea.
Yeah, she was 33, I think, when Your Nose on Broadway.
That's wild. Okay. Yeah.
Well, and so she's the only cast member from the Fringe production that made it to Broadway because the role of Little Sally was written for her.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean sometimes things get written for people and they're
I know. Oh, that's
she
a
really
whole dramatic
made it
thing.
Through the rain.
Oh, there are two things I want to make sure that we talk about with this show, because there's some backstage drama with this show that maybe some listeners aren't aware of. Quite a few lawsuits after Year in Town closed on Broadway. But then on top of that, some drama on the way to Broadway, because so let me set the scene for y'all. Picture it. It's Europe, circa 1995, and Greg Kotis is part of the Neo-Futurists, which is a Chicago-based performance troupe. They do a lot of political satire and shit like that, and he was like an aspiring playwright, and he stayed behind because he wanted to absorb the culture and eventually buy an engagement ring for his fiance, and he started to run out of money pretty quickly, and he came
he had
across
$300 and he wanted to stay in Paris for weeks and like go to Amsterdam. $300,
that tells you what kind of man Greg Kotis is and was. And I listened to him in an interview on a podcast a little while ago in prep for this. He's a very dry person, and it makes absolute sense to me that at that time he was like, I've got enough money to last me 6 months. No, Greg, no, you don't. And there were public amenities in Paris, I think he said, where you had to pay in order to use the restrooms. And this,
yeah, everywhere in London, I think it was in London, that everywhere is, you know, it's pay to use the toilet. Some are nice, some are crappy.
Yeah. And well, and the part of the reason it was to keep homeless people from basically setting up camp in those establishments. And there were days when he said he had to decide if he was going to pay for a sandwich for, you know, his meal for the day, or if he was going to pay to go to the bathroom. And he was like, that's a really interesting conundrum to have. I should write that down. And then he said, imagine if this came to America, what chaos that would cause. And then he realized, because he is very political and environmentally conscious, he was like, you know, that is something we have to think about for the future. And that kind of gave him the idea of, well, what if some giant monopolizing corporation in America was in charge of all the fees for these public amenities? That would be a disaster. And he goes, well, that sounds like a really good idea for a musical, because it's too weird to be a play. And he, which I love his reasoning, is like, too weird to be a play. That
has to be a musical.
Yeah, that's got to be a musical. And he doesn't really like musicals all that much, he said. He always thought they were kind of odd and silly. But he knew Mark Holman, who was an aspiring composer, and they, you know, they knew each other from college, and they were both Chicago based. So they spent the better part of like 3 years writing Urinetown, and they were trying to get it, you know, produced anywhere in Chicago, and no theaters would produce it. They all were like, listen, we like this, but our subscribers average about 95 years old. We can't do your show. And as luck would have it, he did reach out to John Clancy, who was the head of the New York International Fringe Festival at the time. And Clancy was like, yeah, submit it. We could probably do it. And he did. And they were able to put it up. And things progressed pretty quickly from there. David Auburn, who eventually would write Proof, saw the show and got his New York producer friends to come see it. And remember that name, guys, because we are going to cover Proof in a later episode of this season, because that is also an off-Broadway to Broadway transfer. And they spent about two
we're
years
covering
of work-
plays now.
We've been covering plays. They're just harder to do because they're not always bootlegs. Some people don't want to read the scripts. So far, we've covered Torch Song Trilogy, but
yes,
I
did see that episode.
Yes, with Mama, which for anyone who listened to that episode knows major parallels to my life in that play, which we did not expect until we were sitting there watching it. And my mom just kept turning to me throughout all of International Stud being like, see anything you recognize, bitch? I'm like, yes, bitch. Now watch the play. the drama I was referring to is that Spencer Caden was the only actress from the Fringe production who got to transfer to the off-Broadway production at 54th Street, because the Broadway producer said, we want to recast this with all Broadway talent and we want to get a Broadway director. And the writer said, okay, well, then we would like extra time to develop it. And there was a lot of tension about that because, you know, Holman and Kotis wrote the show with a lot of their friends in mind who got to do the show at the Fringe. And it sucks when, you know, you are a part of something at the ground level and it's written for you and it goes off without you, without a second thought. And the director of the Fringe production was uber pissed and waited the solid 5 years to sue because he claimed that John Rando and John Caraffa stole a lot of his staging and ideas for the Broadway production. And he said he didn't have the guts to file a lawsuit until they filed their own lawsuit. We'll talk about that lawsuit later on. Do you know about that lawsuit?
I don't know a lot about that. This is very exciting.
The lawsuit that Rando and Caraffa filed against two different regional productions.
Yes, that was the Jen Cody production at the Carousel Dinner Theater. I know that. My really dear friend was Little Sally in that production. And I remember that being a very big dramatic thing of people staging You're in Town with the exact Broadway staging following the Broadway closing and the national tour and the professional rights being released.
Yeah, there was a second theater.
Lots of lawsuits.
Yeah, there was a second theater that did it as well, and they sued both. And they were like talking about, you know, how it was copied exactly, like basically everything down to the T. And after they filed that lawsuit, Joseph McDonald, the original director from the Fringe production, is like, well, now I feel brave enough to file my own lawsuit against them. And it feels like a South Park episode in itself. Or like Roger from American Dad.
Yes, like just suing people for ideas he had 20 years ago.
It's like, oh, we can sue people now? Fantastic. Here I go.
You who find the blimp of evil shun upheaval in the air. Then ask why the ride gets jarry. Now you're sorry. You're up there. Now you're sorry. Now you're sorry. Don't sue me.
But I don't know if you know this as well. When they were doing these readings and workshops of You're in Town before going to Off-Broadway, what was the name of that theater? The one that's on 54th Street?
The Off-Broadway theater? It's on 54th Street. It's the theater, the American Theater of Actors, the Actors American Theater. And it's above the police station.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to last year because I thought I wanted to do You're in Town as our main stage last spring back at that theater.
Mm.
And so I met with the guy who runs it, who's... like he may have passed away 6 or 8 years ago and no one let him know yet. And he doesn't have a computer. He has a phone and paper everywhere. And he's a really nice guy. And I rented 2 weeks of the theater with him and I was waiting for the rights to You're in Town. And I was waiting and I'm still waiting because they have this New York hold on doing the show or something. And when I called him back, he had rented the theater to someone else because legitimately he uses a rotary phone.
Oh my God.
It's that kind of theater. He built it.
Yeah.
And all of that You're in Town scaffolding is still there and up. And that's, you know, wound up being the design for the Broadway transfer. But that all happened at the American Theater for Actors above the courthouse on 54th Street. And I can see it from my apartment.
Yes, you can, because you are in the hood. But Jennifer Laura Thompson talked about sort of that whole off-Broadway experience. You know, it's not really a theater. Like, it wasn't built to be one. So the backstage areas, you know, everyone's just sort of like in a giant tent. And you can hear anytime like someone flushes a toilet, you can hear it like from all over the place. So it worked very well for that show. But when they were doing these workshops and readings, basically everybody but Nancy Opel thought it was terrible and wanted out of it. And everyone kept sticking with it. Because most of their like agents and managers, I guess, had seen it at Fringe. And they're like, no, you don't understand. Like, this is going to be very good. This is going to be very good for you. And the only person who was really in the original off-Broadway to Broadway production, who was Broadway talent, who was, you know, established enough that they probably could walk away was John Cullum. Everybody else was sort of, you know, of the community. But no one was like Hunter Foster, Jennifer Laura Thompson were not really names yet.
Jeff McCarthy is kind of, you know. I mean, I would say was the second biggest star
Yeah, he was like the godfather of cult musicals for Broadway with Sideshow and Smile. And, you know, he'd been around, but he wasn't like huge. He had, I guess, with Sideshow, he could sort of attract some of those fans to come see it. Nancy Yopel had been semi-retired at that point, so she kind of came out of retirement to do it, and that sort of revitalized her career. Jennifer Laura Thompson was a very, you know, consistently working actress, but while Footloose was a big get for her, it didn't really, like, put her in the high echelon of young actresses.
No, because she was, like, a soprano playing a belty teenager. She had just gotten off the national tour of Carousel, and then the next thing she did was Footloose on Broadway. Yeah. And I don't know where in the world is a Julie Jordan and Ariel, whatever her last name is. I won't be on your Footloose episode. I can tell you that tonight.
Ariel Butts her last name.
That's, Moore. I mean, that's... Ariel Moore.
Ariel Moore.
I did know it.
There you did know it. Look at you.
I'm disgusting. I'm going to the roof of my building and jumping off because this knowledge is so like, I should be like, I should know about, you know, political things, and I could tell you Ariel's last name if you give me 30 seconds.
If I could, ugh. I've always said if I could make my brain understand law or medicine, I would be so rich and so successful.
No,
but unfortunately, yeah. Like that, science does not compute in my brain. Unfortunately, I have challenged myself to learn more about those things because
well,
knowing
you should.
Ariel,
well, you should. As someone who's a mite older than you, I know everything I'm going to know.
Just a smidgen older.
There's nothing anyone can teach me. Keep going.
This is true. I've tried, and you slapped me across the face in public every time I've tried to teach you something.
Happy to stand by that.
Yep, absolutely. Right. But like everyone who else was in it was of the Broadway community, but not like really of such standing that they could really afford to walk away. They all had a 1 week out during that original off-Broadway production, and all throughout the rehearsal process, everyone just was always aware that they had the 1 week out. And at one point, a producer, because the Dodgers came on for the off-Broadway run, which was sort of helped give the show some buzz when it was off-Broadway.
That's when the Dodgers were Dodgers.
Back in the day when the Dodgers were Dodgers, someone from the Dodgers came in to like watch, sit through a rehearsal. And apparently one of them said like, oh, you know, we all know you have the 2 week out. And Jeff McCarthy shouted very loudly, no, it's 1 week. Nope. 1 week. You gave us 1 week. He said we could quit. We could give you 1 week notice, something like that. And apparently that's sort of how everybody felt. And, you know, they would stand there in rehearsals and just like ask each other, like, is this funny? And only Nancy Yopel and Spencer Caden had to be like, no, this is funny. Like, believe me, like this is going to kill. And it wasn't until the first performance they did it. And Jeff McCarthy said, and John Colman said, you know, it wasn't until that first performance they realized they were on a good show. It took literally the very first laugh from the audience for them to go, oh, I guess I'm not in like the worst thing of all time. And luckily they all kind of stuck with the show for a long time. Cause even after it opened on Broadway, a lot of them did the whole 2.5 year run or like they left and then they came back.
Yeah. I think it was so well received.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was a lot of excitement about it. And once I'm sure they got to Broadway, and also it was such a crazy time after 9/11 to be in a show like that honestly was joyous and funny and smart. It was really nice in contrast to Millie, which was big old-fashioned musical, the Some Like It Hot of that year. And you know, it had a lot. I loved Millie, had so much going for it. And then there was this great brother-sister on Broadway story that, you know, we hadn't seen much of. And it was like, he's the star of this and she's the star of this. And they're up for Tonys. And it was like, yeah. it felt
exciting. Well, their shows were up for Tonys. Hunter famously was not nominated.
Oh, yes, not nominated.
Yeah. Hunter and Jeff. Jeff McCarthy not being nominated for this show is one of the biggest what the fucks for me.
Yeah, that is shocking. Can you tell me who was nominated that year? It was Mamma Mia.
Mark, can I tell you what was nominated that year? First of all, I'm not even looking at any Wikipedia or papers.
He's not.
For Jeff McCarthy's category or for musical? Because I can tell you both.
I want to know his category.
Jeff McCarthy's category. Shuler Hensley for Oklahoma, who won.
Okay.
Who was probably always going to win because he won the Olivier. And yeah. There was all the buzz about like, he's the Judd. That redefines the role. Mark Kudish for Millie.
Okay.
Brian D'Arcy James for Sweet Smell of Success.
Oh.
Greg Edelman for Into the Woods.
Oh.
Yeah. And then Greg Edelman, Brian D'Arcy James, Mark Kudish. Shuler Hensley, and then who's the fifth? I mean, 4 out of 5 ain't too bad.
No, it's pretty good.
Fuck, who is the fifth?
I don't know.
Because that was
anyone. It couldn't have been anyone in Mamma Mia. There was no
Mamma Mia. It was Louise Petra and Judy Kay. Those are the ones from Mamma Mia who got nominated. It's Sweet Small Success, Mamma Mia, Millie.
Oh, Gavin Creel. Didn't he get nominated?
For actor. He got nominated for actor.
Oh, lead. Wow.
Yeah, lead actor. Okay. So lead actor, I can tell you, it's John Lithgow for Sweet Small Success, Gavin Creel for Millie, Patrick Wilson for Oklahoma. Yeah. John McMartin for Into the Woods, and then John Cullum for Year in Town. Yes. God, who was the fifth one for? Oh, Norbert Leo Butz for Thou Shalt Not.
Oh, Thou Shalt Not.
All I know from that one is Tugboat.
I make Rochelle Rock talk to me about it every time I see her.
I would love to meet Rochelle Rock and ask her about Thou Shalt Not. Oh, God.
She's just the greatest. Shout out to Rochelle Rock's new single, Drop Swing, available now on Spotify. Play it. Get ready for your night out.
Well,
if you're getting tired in the car, put on Drop Swing.
That's nothing. My single is dropping. For any 30 Rock fans out there, my single is dropping.
My single is dropping. All right. Yeah. Carry on.
Jeff McCarthy did not make it in there, and
it's a crime.
It is a crime, and he'll tell you.
And it's a hard, cold tumble of a journey, worthy of a gurney, a bumbled down, a slapped face, smacked with a mace, certain to debase as I stumbled down. It's a path that I lead you only one place, horrible to retrace, a crumbled down. A hard, cold tumble of a tourney, jumble of a journey to urine town. Julie Cassidy.
I mean, he's also a very sexy motherfucker.
Very tall, good-looking dude. You know he's Michigan J. Frog. I don't have to tell you that.
Michigan J. Frog.
What? So the WB used to have a frog.
Michigan Wait, J. Yes, Frog, yes, with the top
and
hat.
Used to sing and have a top hat, and that's Jeff McCarthy.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
That must have paid for his kids' college.
I think it probably did.
Yeah, because Sideshow and Smile sure didn't.
They sure did not.
Sure did not. This show is interesting because, as you said, you know, with 9/11, there was all this buzz coming from off-Broadway to Broadway. It was a big hot ticket off Broadway, and then there was excitement about this, you know, bold original musical. It was weird, but it was good. It was all this Broadway talent with a lot of people who were sort of like just waiting to sort of break through and become stars, and this was going to be the show that did it, because everyone in this original company is just like really strong character based actors with like amazing voices. You got Nancy Opel and Jennifer Laura Thompson, who sang so amazingly well. And
let's pause for a hot quick second.
Yeah,
Jennifer Laura Thompson is perfection in everything. Mm-hmm. But this show in particular, that level of like, just first of all, gorgeousness, mm-hmm. and then the comedy chop, and then that voice. It's like, bang, 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 you've hit it out of the park, yeah. Sister Act.
Absolutely.
She's a star.
She has a gorgeous voice, beautiful soprano with a glorious mix and chest. And she uses it in so many different colors in the show. Like, you listen to her in Follow Your Heart, and then you listen to her in I See a River, or Follow
I
the River.
See a river
floating the freedom.
It's so good. She's so smart. I mean, to be an ingenue who's funny is, mm-hmm. like, you know, there are 10 of them. And like on Earth, Laura Benanti, I'll think of some more.
Yeah, there are eight other examples. You know, it's hard to tell which ingenues are funny and which aren't, because there are so few funny ingenue roles.
Yeah.
And so there are not many opportunities. And what makes Hope such a great character? I was listening to other podcasts about it, trying to like get some more historical facts.
And there are a lot of Urinetown podcasts.
Well, theater podcasts that talked about Urinetown. Imagine if there was a podcast that was just solely about Urinetown.
Every
week is a different second of Urinetown discussed.
Oh my God.
But no, I was listening to one. They were sort of talking about how they felt that Bobby and Hope were the least interesting characters of the show. That, you know, oh, if I had my druthers, I would be Little Sally or Officer Lockstock any day of the week. I'm like, you're not special. Those are two amazing roles. But I would argue Urinetown has like half a dozen or eight, you know, amazing roles. And Hope and Bobby are two amazing roles. They're not bland. They play up on the fact that ingenue and juvenile roles tend to be bland. But they are very funny, wonderful roles. And all you have to do is listen to Jennifer Laura Thompson's line deliveries in Follow Your Heart, where she goes, of course you wouldn't, because then you'd be dead. Or when they're connected. So like,
when she, my favorite joke of hers is when he's talking about the bunny and she goes, actually, I don't think they do. When he's like, bunnies, they drive a car. And she's like, actually, I don't think they're just so serious.
Yeah, she, don't think they do. Yeah, she's so determined about it. The song Mark is referring to is when it's Hope is, and her father are told that the poor are uprising. And Hope, because she just came from the most expensive university in the world, has all this empathy. She wants good in the world. And so when her father's showing his true colors of being a mean-spirited, you know, monopolizer, he's convincing her how life isn't fair and using the song Don't Be the Bunny. Like, you're either the schmuck or you're not. And he's using the bunny as the image. But she's taking it always at face value when he's talking about, like, a bunny in a toll booth. She goes, but daddy, bunnies don't drive cars.
Don't drive.
And then you're like, don't they, Hope? And she goes, no. As a matter of fact, I don't think they do. Like, she's so...
Did
she's
you
so...
put that into the podcast right here?
Oh, so it's all going in. It's all going in.
A little bunny at a toll booth.
You heard me.
But daddy, bunnies don't drive cars.
Don't they?
No. Actually, I don't think they do.
Live long enough, Hope, dear. You see many things.
Even a daughter doubting her father?
They're just so unaware that they're commenting on their own situation, which is this whole point of You're in Town. No one's ever supposed to be knowingly commenting. And the whole Follow Your Heart sequence, which is the scene where Bobby and Hope fall in love very quickly. They're playing up on the tropes of, like, how in so many Golden Age musicals, characters fall in love very quickly. And
or in Hallmark movie.
Or in
Lindsay Lohan's Christmas.
Any Christmas movie.
Extravaganza.
I haven't watched it yet. I don't watch Christmas movies till after Thanksgiving. I cannot.
You know
wait.
What? I stand by that. And I don't like, listen, if you got your Christmas tree up before Thanksgiving, I need you to look inward.
Exactly. Look at your life. Look at your choices. Don't be the bunny.
Yes.
But I can't wait for the Lindsay Lohan. What's it called? Falling for Christmas.
Falling for Christmas. Don't worry. She gets amnesia. She still knows the lyrics to every Christmas song.
Of course she
do. Her own name. I was like midway through the movie, I'm like, is she a mermaid? Like, she doesn't know how to do anything. It's hilarious.
Look over there. Oh my God. How very odd. And what might they be? But so in Follow Your Heart, Bobby and Hope are talking about, you know, their emotional openness. You know, Bobby's feeling dejected because he basically sent his father off to God knows where, we know, to send his father off to die. And at first they're talking about their hearts in the metaphorical sense, right? I don't know how to listen to my heart. And then it just gets very literal, but they still connect in that way. And I love it very much. And when she's listening to Bobby's heart quite literally, and they connect because she realizes that her heart was saying just the other day what his heart was saying. And their dialogue just ramps up and up. And he goes, I didn't know two hearts could speak as one. And Jennifer Lawrence.
I didn't
goes,
either.
And she goes, I didn't either. It's so good.
Jesus. I didn't mean to steal your joke, but I had to. It's so good.
It's so good.
She just screams it. I didn't sir.
Until now. Or also when she listens to his heart for the first time, she's like, let me give it a try. And there's a long pause. He goes, do you hear any shush?
I mean, it's great writing,
yeah,
but it's perfect delivery. So it's like, good. You know, that is such a gift for a young ingenue to get to try to they have the jokes, whereas if in wild contrast to Laura Benanti making everything funny and She Loves Me, which is not particularly funny,
yeah,
that to me is like, that's a much harder job. But here in You're in Town, you get the jokes. You just got to land the plane. It shouldn't be that hard.
Exactly. If you play it earnestly and sort of get out of the show's way, it will reward you immensely. If you try to make it funny, you'll still get laughs because the
honestly, that's most comedies. It's like you know, that's like the acting thing. You're playing it seriously. It has to be life or death for you. Mm-hmm. And you know, if it's not, we're commenting. Then we're in Forbidden Broadway or something. We're commenting on what the joke is, and the actor needs to know what it is, but the character can't.
Yeah, an actor, you have to figure out at what pitch you're setting the emotions at. So it's not so much that it's like, oh Jesus, but you also can't, you do not want to show the audience that you are smarter than the material, that you know it's funny. Situation comedies are the way they are because we're laughing at the antics of characters who are in situations that are just so ridiculous. And that's what makes this original company so good, because that's how they all play it. The way, I mean, Nancy Opel's line deliveries, even every time she talks about get your head out of the clouds, Bobby Strong, get your head out of the clouds. Oh, Bobby, what's to become of you? What's to become of us all? I also love when it's revealed that Pennywise, that's her last name, right? Miss Pennywise?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you find out that Pennywise is Hope's mother, which is another joke I love that not enough people find as funny as I do, because Hope is my daughter and I'm her mother. I just, I love the separate, they are
separate
realizations.
There's like a very big pause. Hope is my daughter.
And I am her mother.
Bigger.
Yeah, exactly.
The second one has to be much bigger, right?
Exactly. What is your favorite song in this show, Mark?
I was just looking up something to bring up, but I would say my favorite musical number in this musical. Sweet. I want to look at all of my song options.
There are quite a few.
I mean, I think the finale is really quite good. I'm going to the cast album. I should be ready for this question.
There are a million questions you should be ready for.
There's a million questions I should be ready for. Okay. I mean, yeah, I think I See a River is probably the best thing in the show. And I think also maybe, I guess Follow Your Heart. I mean, I'm a big fan of the ingenue in a musical and their moments.
Yeah.
And also, like, this is what I will say about this, and you can do a little edit so that all was better. But what I will say about this is that this isn't like the world's greatest score to listen to. It's fun to listen to every few years. It'll pop in. I'm like, oh, I want to hear You're in Town Again. And that those songs are a bop, or that song's really great, but it's not a score I'm like, I must listen to on a monthly basis. You know, it's not for me, a Bridges or a Blood Brothers in the way that I'm like, I love this score. But I think it's great and it's perfect for what this is. So, yeah, that's where I am.
Sorry, Blood Brothers.
That score is so good. You're out of your mind.
Maybe. Call me what you will. But no, the thing about this score, I mean, it's the score is reminiscent of Kurt Weill and Blitzstein with Cradle of Rock. You know, it is Three Penny Opera meets Cradle of Rock meets West Side Story and Les Mis, with like a little bit of Fiddler involved with What Is Your In Town. And Weill with his time with Brecht, like, again, the Three Penny Opera is a genius score, but it's not a score you sit around like bopping.
Correct. To. You're not giving it a listen.
No, show me the person that says, I do my household chores to Mahogany, and I will show you a sociopath. I love Viola, but like of all of his scores, I'm listening to, you know, Lady in the Dark over anything, because that's more like Broadway-y. And so You're in Town is definitely kind of Viola Blitzstein light, and there are other songs that have different inflections. But yeah, like there are certain songs that I will have no problem listening to on repeat. Like I'll listen to Nancy Opel fucking slay Privilege to Pee over and over again.
It's thrilling. And Carol Lee was also so good in that show.
I wish I'd seen Carol Lee. I wish I'd seen Victoria Clark. I wonder what she was.
I don't remember. I don't think I must have not seen her, because I have no recollection of seeing her in the show. So yes.
Yeah.
But it had to have been different. She certainly doesn't sing like that.
She doesn't. Well, and so I think I'm not sure what the reasoning behind it was, because not like Victoria Clark was a name. She was a known in the community actress.
A Broadway mainstay.
Yes, exactly. She did about 2 years before Piazza. And again, like I said, you know, this original company, either you had people who stayed the entire run, or people who, you know, were there for a year and a half, left for a minute, and then came back. Nancy Opel was in the show for, you know, about a year and a half, and then Victoria Clark did it for about 5 months, and then Carol Lee Carmello closed out the show. From what Nancy Opel talks about, the original voice type for Pennywise was the Victoria Clark type. Like, they originally wrote it to be much more classical soprano. So it was like, the good Lord made sure that we piss each day, because they were trying to lean into that classical sound. And when they brought in Nancy for the first reading and they were teaching her the song, she, I guess, because, you know, it was very short notice and she was a little out of practice, she didn't want to have to worry about her placement. And she's Nancy Opel. So she's like, I'm just going to belt it. And the writers were like, sure, go ahead, I guess.
Sure, that's thrilling.
Yeah. Well, the way she describes it, she like came in for her audition for the reading, working with the music director on it. And they're like, and they get in the room and the music director turns to the writers and goes, so just fair warning, Nancy has decided she's going to belt all of it. And the writer's response was like, I guess, like, have at, probably it's probably going to blow. And then she did it and they're like, cool, so never change. And yeah, we're going to do it that way forever.
We'd like to cast you. What is your favorite song in the musical?
To listen to, probably Follow Your Heart or the Act One finale. Yeah, the Act One finale. I mean, I think that Act One finale is just so well built. But to watch, especially the original staging of it, I love to watch Snuff That Girl, because it is one of my favorite moments of choreography. Because, and I don't like, I'm not a John Carafa stan by any means. I thought, you know, he's the man.
Are there ones?
Actually, Mark,
well, just because it's like so niche, like, yeah. Oh my god, you know what I'm a stan of?
Well, so,
like, you know,
he had this and Into the Woods of the same season, and then followed it up with John Rando with Dance of the Vampires. And the thing about Dance
Which
of the Vampires,
I saw.
Did you?
Oh, I saw all of those things. Yeah.
Oh god, I sometimes I wish I was you.
I wish that you were alive in the 90s, because in that same way, there just was like nothing was better than like 1994. You know, like,
yeah,
well, it never quite got as good again.
I fear if I were a New York City going teenager in 1994, I would have seen that carousel so many times.
Oh my
that
god,
that Audra and Sally would have put out a say what?
You would have still be at the theater.
Yeah, I would have died there. Sally Murphy and Audra McDonald and Michael Hayden would have had restraining orders put out against me. So I know I'm seeing Downstate at Playwrights tomorrow. Simply,
honestly,
because
they should consider taking them out now.
Oh, I am very respectful. How dare you? I am seeing Downstate because Sally Murphy is in it, but I will not wait around for her. I will go see it. I'll support it and I'll leave. I'm All a very right, respectful great. Stalker.
I'm going in 2 weeks or next week. Maybe I'm going next Tuesday.
And I'm seeing Anne Juliet next Tuesday, but
I'm going tomorrow to opening.
Oh, well, look at you. She's very famous.
She had to get a PCR test to go. So
they don't want to miss his Doubtfire opening night disaster on their hands. Snuff That Girl. You're saying Arthur Junker office
choreography. Thing. Sorry. Go back to
that. Well, there are, because that's the following season when Dance of the Vampires happened. There is a certain group of teenage theater fans when I was growing up were like, taboo, like if you were the taboo kind of kid, you were, and not just taboo fans, like teenage taboo fan, there was a certain kind of intensity about you. And that was also a carryover from Dance of the Vampires, weirdly enough. And I had a couple of quote unquote dancer friends. I put dancer in quotations, because just because you go to a dance class doesn't make you a dancer. But they were huge Dance of the Vampire fans, because they kept on saying, say what you will about the plot, you've never seen dancing like it before. And so for like my entire high school career, I would always just hear about how John Carafa was like the most underrated choreographer on Broadway.
All right. Well, and possible.
Possibly. But what does make a good argument for him is his choreography for Snuff That Girl, where he pays huge homage to Cool in West Side Story, to the point where like they do the...
You do the run and the jump.
But there's a whole thing about the snapping that they do in like in one of the major breaks. Yeah.
And they're all snapping like not in time and just like angry about it. It's pretty genius.
It is. It's very genius. What he talked about with choreographing Urinetown was that it was trial and error of throwing things out and seeing what works. But the main idea every time he was choreographing a number was, I want the choreography to sort of just be beyond the reach of the actors, to make it feel like these real people in a musical who think that they're Sid Charisse and Fred Astaire, but don't really have the ability. So he's like, I don't want them to look bad. I just don't want it to look amazing. So they would figure out exactly like what was too easy and what was too hard and try to find the middle ground. So Snuff That Girl is, you know, we got Jen Cody, who is a dancer, but like everyone else who's mostly character actors trying to do their best version of cool. And they commit so hard to it. As you said, like it's angry snapping, it's angry jazz movements. And we have, speaking of Sideshow, we've got Ken Jennings as Hot Blades Harry, who also is, you know, Old Man Strong in Act One. But I was watching him in a cabaret talk about this, where they were figuring out the attitude for Snuff That Girl, what everyone should do and how they should be acting when they're not dancing. And John Rando turns to Ken Jennings. He goes, okay, so Hot Blades Harry, he's evil, but he's evil in a musical. So what does that look like? And Ken Jennings, who's like, you know, dad bod squat man, like short Irish man, the original Tobias in Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, he's like literally 4'11".
Yeah, but like 4'11" with, you know, like a thick build. Yeah,
he's a thick body.
Yeah. And so
daddy.
And so he decided, well, I think, and he's also Irish, so he's like, I think that evil bevels. And so he would take his hands and like put them on his abdomen, but like with the, no one can see me, only Mark can see me right now, with like his hands sort of squashed inward.
This isn't aired live.
Sadly, no, I don't have the means. But his like hand squished in on his abdomen, like pigeon chest, while always like beveling really harshly. So it was
It was like, imagine your dad in Chicago. That's what it looked like.
Yeah,
it was
your dad on stage really pissed off in Chicago. Like he's being he's in Cell Block Tango. Your dad is doing Cell Block Tango, full on, no irony whatsoever. So it's that kind of energy. So when you watch it, like you listen to it, and it is a bop, especially in that like the drum section and the dance break, but you watch it and you're like, this is fucking genius. Who's your favorite character in You're in Town?
I'm gonna go Hope. I think it's just JLT. Yeah, was so transformative to me, and I became a lifelong fan of hers after seeing her in that show. Mm-hmm. And I love her commitment to being good and how it just doesn't work out for her ultimately. And I just think the character is so interesting. And, you know, I always sort of pick, it's normally a female lead when I'm directing something to like really see the show through. And Hope is that for me. And then Little Sally is a close second. I can't think of any musical where I would tell you the man is my favorite character.
It is rare for me as well when the male character is my favorite character. This might be one of the few exceptions. And part of it is the performance of Jeff McCarthy, but part of it also is all of his scene work with Little Sally that makes Officer Lockstock maybe my favorite character. And I mean, I don't listen to his song when I'm listening to the score.
Yeah,
I listen to Hope stuff.
That's a skip.
Yeah. Well, I know I like the song, but yeah, it's a skip.
No, if I was watching it, it's fine. It's a fun number. Yeah. All the flashlights, I remember maybe. Last night when I was watching Act One, I fast forwarded through that. I was like, I'm not watching this shit. It's midnight.
At least you're consistent. No, of all like the music stuff, Hope's definitely my favorite. And yes, maybe it's because I'm secretly an ingenue in my heart. I want to do like a whole concert of ingenue songs. And I mean, JLT.
Great, just what we need.
Yeah, a gay boy doing all the ingenue shit. Great. I can never play these roles on Broadway, so I'm going to sing all of Funny Girl and Carousel and make you guys pay to see it. But
if I'm directing.
Lifelong fan with this show for me as well. Even though I did not see her in it, I got into the cast recording right before she did Wicked, and I had seen her in Footloose live. So I remember when she replaced Kristen Chenoweth in Wicked, that was like a very big deal for a lot of us, because Tony nominee coming in, we're like, oh, they're gonna like, we're gonna do luxury casting for these replacements from here on out. And then it was never that luxurious ever again. Always talented women, but never like Tony nominee so-and-so is the new Glinda. But I mean, you
the first replacements are like a whole different
ballgame
in a hot hit show.
And I think they were also figuring out like how long of legs do we have after the original cast leaves? Is this something that's only a big hit for the first 2 years? Is this going to be a 10-year run? And they learned.
And
pretty
she
quickly.
Was so that was a smart move to cast her because you don't think of her as a Kristen Chenoweth type. Mm. So for her to go on, you know, do Wicked and be the second Glinda, like she looks more like Billy Burke. She's a bigger woman. Like she's tall. She has, you know, height. She's not like this little cute little nothing. She's like a woman.
Yeah.
And so it was fun to see Glinda like that. And then, you know, it gives them flexibility moving forward that they don't have to have a Kristen Chenoweth impersonator, you know, after another.
Yeah. She was a good transitional Glinda in that sense, because she is like Cheno. She is a very funny soprano, like geniusly funny. Yeah. And she doesn't do manic. She does very smart comedy. Like she could do insane comedy if she wanted to, if it called for it. But I remember, because I saw Cheno and I saw JLT. I made it a point to see JLT, and then I didn't see Wicked again for like 17 years.
Okay.
Yeah. But every Glinda after Jennifer Laura Thompson stopped making Glinda a person in Act One. They made her like a 5-year-old, which I always hated watching videos of everyone else after her. JLT's kept the one thing she kept of Cheno was like Glinda's Act One. She's vapid, but she's still a human being. And that's what makes it similar to like the Hope and all the Urinetown stuff. It's like, it makes it funny because Glinda doesn't know that she's funny. It's very real for her. Yeah. Like her logic is insane. And to watch Jennifer Laura Thompson just play like, yes, 2 + 2 does equal pink. And the audience just like,
so laughing. 10 out of 10 for Jennifer Laura Thompson.
Absolutely.
This podcast is sponsored by Jennifer Laura Thompson fan club.
Well, I think we found out who our diva is, who's going to close us out tonight. Did you forget we close out every episode with a diva, Mark?
I did forget.
Yes. Well, in your defense, it's been a solid 9,000 years since you've last been on the podcast.
I haven't done this podcast since you keep asking me to do shows that I like don't really know that well.
No, I gave you options this time. You picked your
own. And I don't, and all the not all the good ones, all the ones I knew you said other people took them.
It's true. They did take them. Okay. How about this? You lovely, lovely bitch who I hate and love very dearly.
Great.
The next series, I'm going to run to your stupid gay face and go, Mark, here's the next series. First pick.
It's probably going to be something weird that I also don't know or care about. It's going to be like shows that are based on Shakespearean novel. And you can just go
Shakespearean novels.
It's going to be some bullshit where my options are to talk about like hair or
you can talk about Murat Saad, you can talk about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
You're like, what we want you to really talk about here tonight is Tale of Two Cities, the musical.
No, I'll make sure it's a good
one. Only really
talk
about Act One, to be totally honest.
I can only tell you about the fake musical of Tale of Two Cities that was done in the movie Simple Wish with Martin Short and Mara Wilson.
Wow, I'm sorry I missed that.
Many people did.
Back to Urinetown.
I don't know. I just love all the Officer Lockstock, Little Sally interactions, and clearly Broadway did too, because they were recurring characters for the Easter Bonnet every year.
Oh my God! And man, was that funny. So to explain it to the people at home, at the Broadway Cares Easter Bonnet, it's at the used to be at the new. I think it's still at the New Amsterdam Theater, and all the Broadway shows do presentations, and Officer Lockstock and Little Sally. And it was Jen Cody and I can't remember whoever the understudy was.
Yeah.
And they were our hosts for the evening or the afternoon. And they just like talk shit about every Broadway show, every Broadway star. It was so mean-spirited and amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was like for 3 years at least, I think. That's when I used to like.
They might have done it for another year or two after Urinetown closed. And then probably
mostly after Urinetown closed. Maybe it was the first year was their last year on Broadway. And then they did it for the next couple of years and was like a blast.
Yeah.
Such a funny, Jen Cody's pretty brilliant.
She is. I mean, people definitely were looking forward to it. It was, you know, definitely a roasting of everything. And it was really, but like Lockstock and Little Sally, because of sort of the dichotomy of their size, of their vocal types, of their age, so to speak, and their different perspectives with her innocence and his world weariness. It always just made a good blend. And because Year in Town is a bit of a smartassy show, they could afford to be smartassy because they come on stage and everyone's like, okay, here we go. They're going to make jokes about all of us. And it's, you know, like when you go to a roast, you know, you're going to get dragged for filth. So you just got to go in knowing that anything's on the table and just have good fun with it, which for a while people did. But there's so much about their blend in this show that's so fascinating to me. And like, especially because Officer Lockstock, for all intents and purposes, is one of the show's villains, even though he's also the narrator.
And it's not a villain we don't like, you know, yeah. The audience like really likes, it's not a villain you boo at.
Yeah.
Like
he's not
Hans or whatever in Frozen.
Hans and Frozen. Yeah. Or, you know, boo. Captain Hook. Yeah. Mrs. Mears, all those villains. No, because Lockstock is more, he carries out the injustice, but he's not necessarily in charge of it all. But, and also on top of that, I guess because he's the one who has all the insight into the show. I don't know. There's a weird thing where it's like we trust him even though he is responsible for a lot of the murders that happen at Urinetown. And he also, I mean,
love a murder in a musical.
Yeah, he also has some of my favorite lines when Act Two begins and he's, you know, saying, you know, people don't know what Urinetown is. There's a lot of confusion. That's why we like it. Little boy once asked me, "Is Urinetown actually a nice place to live? Gingerbread houses along golden frothy canals." Like Venice, only different. For some reason, that line gets me. Like Venice, only different.
Only different.
I think like Venice, only different. I didn't say yes. I didn't say no either. It's like the kind of weird that just fucking is up my alley. And it's the kind of. So, okay. The thing we should talk about. Because we do have a bit more time. Yes. Yeah. You're
oh, we're fine.
Yeah. Great. Amazing. Mark asked before we recorded everybody. How much time I thought we needed. And when I told him how long the last couple of episodes went, I'm pretty sure you were about to unfriend me on all social media, just not because you were going to go that long, but because I don't think you wanted to be associated with anybody who would ever create a podcast that would go that long.
Well, it's just like, even when I released my podcast, Little Me Growing Up Broadway, on the Broadway Podcast Network, available on streaming platforms. Mm-hmm. Whenever I release an episode and it's over an hour, I'm like, oh, no one's going to listen to this.
Well,
sometimes I just, you know, I'm just talking to someone who played Annie and I've got lots of questions.
As well, you should. Here's the thing, though. I've now put myself into a corner, Mark, because I now do these long form episodes. And you were on the Matilda one, which I think was like an hour and 30, maybe an hour and 40. And I'll do these super long episodes, like really long episodes. And then I'll go, OK, the next one should be a lot shorter. Like this one was close to 3. This one, let's try to make it an hour and 45. And people won't listen to the hour and 45 one as quickly. And I think part of it is my listeners now go, oh, if it's under 2 hours, they didn't have much to say. And I'm like, no, we tried to be like really concise this time. I tried to have fewer tangents, or like my guest had somewhere to be. So we tried to just cover everything as soon as possible. But I've had listeners DM me being like, oh, this one was only an hour and 30. Like, was there
is
nothing
everything
to talk-
okay at home?
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like even recently when I've been recording, I'm like at the 45 minute mark and I'm like, let me wrap this up. I'm like, I don't have time to do this and no one has time to listen to this. So
yeah,
the episodes of Little Me are getting shorter and shorter.
They're getting littler.
Eventually
littler,
it's just going to be like me playing one song from a cast album being like, bye guys. See you next week. Certainly would be easier.
I would listen to that podcast in a heartbeat.
Great.
Who was your most recent guest?
The most recent episode is Danielle Brisebois, who was Molly in the original cast of Annie, and then went on to be the star of Archie Bunker's Place. Mm-hmm. And she was on All in the Family, and she was on every 80s sitcom. And we had a really fun chat about her career. And she also wrote Pocketful of Sunshine and Unwritten with Natasha Bedingfield. Like, she's an incredible songwriter now, and that's my most recent episode.
Molly's slaying the game. I heard she taps up a damn storm in that Tony performance, and
she sure does, and that's because she tapped. And they yeah. like all those orphans, like she had a choice to pick her orphan name. Mm-hmm. You know, like all it's so fascinating to be involved in something that has had such a huge life.
Yeah.
And there's no escaping it. It's not like, oh, I was on Broadway and Thou Shalt Not, and that's your only Broadway credit. It doesn't really come back to haunt you much, except in your nightmares. But like, if you were in the original cast of Annie, there ain't no escaping that.
No, especially one of the original orphans. It's not like, oh, I was in the original cast of Annie and I was Cecile in I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here. It's like, no, I was fucking Molly.
And also, like, it's every school does. Like, you can't, you no. don't, you know, Annie's constantly on your television. Obviously, I'm an Annie stan. And, you know, it's, I think it was so many, this is not what, we're not on the Annie podcast, but
we'll get back to it, I swear.
It just, it's everybody's gateway drug who loves musical theater. And so I have such a great affection for what that musical has done for so many people who mm-hmm. are in this business, and me included.
I would love if we had a production of Annie again, like the original, that was cast with, for lack of a better term, weirdos, because that original cast is a bunch of big personalities. And Martin Charnin made it a point when casting the orphans throughout the entire run, he didn't want cutesy musical theater kids. He wanted, you know,
you wanted real kids.
Faces. Yeah, real
he
kids.
Wanted
odd
kids
faces,
who look
rough.
Like maybe they lost a tooth in a fight.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think she, what's her name? Danielle was missing a tooth on the Tony Awards, something like that.
I think that's probably
right. Yeah, there were a couple of missing teeth in those orphans originally. But I bring this up to connect it back to Year in Town, where
great. That is all good hosting.
It's like I've done this before. That's an original company filled with personalities and oddballs, and you know, people who've gone on to major success since, who had minor success before. I mean, Megan Lawrence was in the original ensemble who would go on to get a Tony nomination for Pajama Game.
And that's why, and she was pregnant, and that's why that character's pregnant. And mm-hmm. that is why Jen Cody was pregnant when she replaced her mm-hmm. In that original cast, so that she could go have her baby.
Yep.
So like, how cool if you're like Megan Lawrence's kid and you're like, that's why that character is pregnant.
Every time. Does the character give birth during I See a River? Is that what they usually do?
I don't remember that.
It would make sense. It would make sense on for many reasons.
Oh yeah, because then she has the baby.
Yeah. Because yes. the last line of the show is Hail Malthus.
Yes. And so it would make sense. About that?
Oh, we're absolutely going to talk about Hail Malthus, but it makes sense for there to be a newborn baby on stage as everyone's dying, because the whole point of the end of the show is once You're in Good Company is destroyed and Cladwell is killed and Hope takes over after Bobby's been killed, is everyone pees for free, everyone has justice and hope and love. And within a very short amount of time, all the water gets used up, because even though Cladwell was an evil, money-grubbing man.
Ruthless
corporate man. America yeah. man. His tactics helped preserve their water supply, which was drying up every day because there hadn't been water in years. And so this is something that's hinted at throughout the show, even Act One finale, when he's singing to Bobby, like, oh, you want happy, this is what you want, like, but what about tomorrow? And Bobby goes, but what about today? And he's like, no. You always have to think about it tomorrow. That's even a recurring line in the show with the stink years. And they talk about the stink years. People lived like there was no tomorrow because there wasn't a tomorrow, but there is always a tomorrow in some way. And tomorrow comes, like Annie says, tomorrow does come. See how I'm bringing it all back
tomorrow
together.
Tomorrow comes. Also, Les Mis.
And Les Mis, yeah, it all connects. It's all connected. When the tomorrow comes at the end of the show, the water is gone. And Hope tries to bask still in the love of everyone by gaslighting them into thinking that they are all the water they need. The water's inside
of you.
Don't you know what you are, Mrs. Strong? A river? That's right. We all are. But Hope eventually does die. And, you know, we have little Sally going, what kind of a musical is this? The good guys take over and everything falls apart. The music's so happy. And she tells Officer Lockstock, no one's going to want to see the musical. Officer Lockstock says it's because people don't want to hear that their way of life is unsustainable, which is true. And little Sally says, just to cut the tension, that, and the title's awful. And they finish with a reprise of You're in Town. Lockstock says, Hail Malthus. Thank you and good night. Malthus. Why Hail Malthus, Mark?
So isn't Malthus, isn't that about how people... there'll always be poor people, there'll always be starving people, there'll always be thirsty people, and that there'll always be someone above them, right? But Malthus is a writer?
Malthus was an 18th century economist and writer.
Okay.
And it's, yes, that is the gist of it. It's part of...
So like, I'm not as dumb as I look.
I'm not as dumb as I am. It's a work he had called An Essay on the Principle of Population as it Affects the Future Improvement of Society. And this came out around 1798. And basically what he said was, as long as humanity keeps producing at a rate greater than the goods that the earth can provide, there will always be the haves and the have-nots. But what he also said was, because it came off of the heels of Ben Franklin saying, or after the Declaration of Independence, that like America's population was going to quadruple in like 5 years or something like that. And Malthus was like, so that's bad. That should not be something to brag about. But he also said, and this is something that was also, that is true and remains to be true, he's like, humanity needs to curb its population. He said, he called marriage, he said something about like marriage was an evil or something like that, because people get married and have too many kids that they can't afford to have, and bleeds resources. But he also said, you know, humanity is never going to stop fucking and making babies, and we're going to keep overpopulating. He goes, the good news is that Earth finds a way every time to cut our population down when we get too big for our britches. He goes, there's famine, there's disease, there are epidemics. So, you know, he was referring to like the Great Plague, which, you know, killed off a third of the world in like 50 years or something like that. But, you know, many other diseases and illnesses and epidemics, and as we've learned, happens
fairly recently.
It keeps happening. People dying is not a laughing matter, but it is funny how we get smarter but never learn. As Mark has told us, you get to a certain age, can't teach anyone nothing.
There's nothing anyone can teach me.
Yeah, but that's the dark side to the satire of Urinetown. And it's, despite all the amazing jokes about the structure of musical theater, despite all the breaking of the fourth walls, the silliness of it all, there is a dark undercurrent to it. And that is sort of said at the end with the Hail Malthus, which always gives me a bit like of a weird culty vibe at the end. Like we've watched this cult. Yeah, we've watched this cult perform for us at the end of the night. And it's not until the last beat that we realize that, oh shit, I'm with like Scientology doing an Easter play about aliens.
I will say Hail Malthus is not my favorite way to end this thing,
mm-hmm.
because that's not something everybody knows.
No.
We've just delivered this beautiful, great, well-crafted musical, and then the last thing the audience hears is something that confuses them. And I'm sure that's on purpose. These are not dumb people who wrote this show, but I just think if I was the director of this original production, I would say we need something else there. I think this is too inside. And people are going to be like, what did he just say? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's not a win when it's too smart for its own good.
Yeah. It's double-edged sword. I think you're right. I also understand if that's sort of the point. And if that's what they want to do, then they've succeeded. Whether it works for everyone is up for debate. Doesn't work for you, clearly. Definitely confuses. It might inspire some people to look it up, but people also can be very dumb and just choose to think that it's a random thing. And
also, I definitely had a flip phone when I saw this show,
mm-hmm.
A Nokia flip. And so I wasn't going to get home, remember Malthus, mm-hmm. try to get onto AOL, look it up, or go to the get a old dictionary. Life used to be very different, sir.
I know, dear. It was so hard to be you back in
the time I got back home at Astoria. I couldn't remember Malthus.
With your water, drinking
my
water.
Water and my daughter.
Oh, shit, are we on caps again? what a nice cool mint help if I shoved your head up your ass. But,
oh, God. Little Me Growing Up Broadway, available on all streaming podcast networks. Just me talking to other people for a much shorter amount of time.
No one's going to listen. They're going to be like, I only want to hear Mark talk for over 2 hours. If it's under 2 hours, so, I'm not interested.
You can come work for me. I never shut the up.
You can hear Mark talk to people much more famous than I, and it's very fun to listen to. Okay. You've had some very impressive people.
I thank you so much. But back to you, baby.
Back to me. It is my time. My moment. But in my research for this, something I love to do with some of these shows, especially if it's around the early 2000s, I like to go back onto Broadway World and use the search bar to see what people were saying at the time during the run or slightly after the run.
What did we find out?
Well, Urinetown was very beloved. There were some replacements that were not beloved. people, you know, obviously it's with fandom, original companies are become sacred and any replacements are terrible. We've gotten a little bit better about that since, but a certain TV actor, Tom Cavanagh, was...
Yeah, he was, no, it was very big at the moment because he had just wrapped playing the role of Ed on Ed, a show I loved actually very much.
A lot of people did. It was a good show.
It was a great, sweet, charming show. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, but it was
maybe
really
Peacock, because I think it was NBC, right?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. He came in to be Bobby Strong and was such a disaster that I think he only did it for like a month, maybe two. Yeah. They had to bring Hunter Foster in again for 3 weeks while they found a better replacement. Because Tom, apparently Cavanagh could handle the scenes, but he could not sing. And
yeah,
that is not
a very big male sing. It's not like an easy score for a TV star to come in and do once.
No, you cannot act your way through Run Freedom Run. No. You have to sing the shit out of it.
Run Freedom Run, run away. I'm afraid you have to run, 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 run Freedom Run away. That freedom song, freedom song, shines today. You better run, 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 run. Hallelujah, run for the win in your head.
I'm surprised. I never understand anyone saying yes to something they actually cannot do. It just blows my absolute Beanie Feldstein mind.
I mean, I love the idea of people, of actors wanting to challenge themselves, but there has to be a sense of humility and self-awareness to know what is challenging and what is just simply beyond your reach. And you also, but not just them. I also want to put the blame on the actors. There are people in charge as well who have to kind of make the tough call of whether the actor can do it or not. And I don't love this toxic positivity in the community where it's like, well, let's make it a safe space for everyone. I'm like, well, no, some people just don't have it's not a slate on the talent that they do have, but some people have different skill sets. Like, you would not cast a young Patti LuPone as Hope Cladwell in You're in Town.
It's That's also not your high school musical, so it's just like not a space for everybody, and that is just sadly the truth. And it's in, of course, this industry needs to be more inclusive as it grows and changes. But, you know, if you can't sing, you can't do it.
Yeah. If you cannot deliver the song as it needs to be delivered, that's part of the job requirement.
And that's just it. It's in the same way. It's like, I shouldn't probably do surgery on you because I'm pretty good with a pair of scissors or a knife. You know what I mean? Like, I'm creative, but I should not remove your spleen.
Also, every musical is built differently. There are roles where you can more act your way through it than sing through it.
Like, and then, Charles Shaughnessy, when he joined the same cast of You're in Town, Segway, as Cladwell B. Caldwell. Caldwell B. Cladwell.
My daughter, she's my sister.
And I think they added a nanny joke. It's just coming to me right now.
That sounds all right.
I need someone to confirm this. Mr. Sheffield is in the office. He was fun, actually.
I'll bet he was fun. He's a very fun, dry actor. And that's a role that you can pretty much act your way through. There's like one big money note for him at the end of Mr. Cladwell that I'm sure they found a way to work around. Mm-hmm. They probably added it for John Cullum, who's like, I am a trained baritone singer. I am 75 and I still got it. You will give me my
now
G.
John Cullum and John McMartin, those are different people.
They are very different people. Okay. Yes, very different people. One
the
of
other
them...
night I was having drinks with a friend and she goes, so what is Anne Juliet? Is it six?
I mean, the gays do Peloton to both of them, so yeah, they're the same thing.
Is it six? Makes me laugh.
it's fun. No, first of all, of John McMartin and John Cullum, one is dead and one's alive.
And I never saw them both in the same place. So I'm just telling you that.
They both did Tina Fey shows. John McMartin was on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and John Cullum did 30 Rock. And John Cullum has two Tony Awards. He's still alive. I saw John Cullum in 110 in the Shade and in Casa Valentina and then in Scottsboro Boys as well. That was a man who kept fucking chugging along up until 90.
Chugging along. Yeah, I saw him in all those things and many other things. He just seemed to have never stopped doing the thing, which is amazing.
He's someone who sort of wakes up every day. He's like, I'll go do a Broadway show. And it's like, you're 95, John. He's like, I'll be there. Perfect attendance too.
Anyway, but Charles Shaughnessy was fun. And that would have been a great place to put TV stars in the show.
Yeah, not the one that requires the big thing.
to the hardest male vocal I've heard in many, many years.
Yeah, definitely the big male sing of that season for sure. Like, I mean, again, Run Freedom Run, that's a big old sing. I don't know how you work your way around the, I said freedom. Like, how do you act your way through that without the notes?
Yeah, I don't think that's an option.
No. Although I do love, there are visual aids to that song. Like when you take, I think is it Becky Two Shoes, where he takes the brace off of her, like, you know.
Oh my God. And she can't walk. He takes the braces off her as if he could heal her.
Yes.
But then she goes to take a step. She falls right the fuck down. Yep. And that is my brand of comedy.
Absolutely. Which makes it even better is like, they do not tease you that she might possibly be able to walk. It's the buildup is he takes it off and she feels the spirit. So you see on her face before she takes the step that she thinks she can walk. And on the very first step, she falls. The very first step.
So good. You know, airplane.
And no one is embarrassed by it. Everyone's just like, okay. And we put the brace back on her. Pick her back up. Wait a moment.
I mean, that direction is so genius. I mean, there's so many things that I'm sure John Rando came up with that or executed beautifully, or like, it'll be funnier if you do this. Because when you have people that are that funny in the ensemble, like Rick Crom is a funny guy, mm-hmm. and everybody's as funny as him, they're going to come up with a lot of stuff. So then it becomes a director's job to manage all of these comedians and their ideas. And this is the kind of show where you bring your thing to it. And so that's sort of why I'm excited to eventually direct this at some point. But, you know, the management of all of those comedians is quite a task, and was expertly done on this show.
Yeah. One of my favorite Tony speeches is Joanna Gleason for Into the Woods. And she talks about how the original cast of Into the Woods are like all a bunch of acrobats who they all like, their job is just to catch each other all the time. It's never about who gets the moment to shine, but rather like, how do you set up the person in your scene?
Yeah.
Which is a very brilliant image, and very perfectly describes that cast and why that original Into the Woods cast is so, you know, gold standard. And it's similar with this Urinetown. And I feel like that's sort of how John Rando controlled everything, was rather than like, okay, how do I, give everyone something that makes them feel okay, but rather like, okay, it has to be an ensemble. Everyone's got to support each other. It's always about leading into the next joke, which means sometimes you have to set it up so someone else can get it. Someone will set you up. Like, it's always just about shifting the power and the focus to each person all the time, which just makes it, just makes it interesting to me in a way that not many comedies are now. Which brings me to my next topic. Something that I think Urinetown ushered on Broadway that no show has been able to do as well since is the meta commentary musical, the spoof parody musical. We see it with Spamalot, Something Rotten. We see it in pieces in other shows, like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels makes fourth wall break jokes. This idea of commenting on what's happening on stage as if all of a sudden, like, all the acting has gone away and like a real person just like, wait a second, like the scenery's moving or something like that. We've seen in Book of Mormon as well. And I don't think any show has been able to do it as well as Urinetown. That's my hot take.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with it. And also, I think this is one of the first mainstream musicals on Broadway that's commenting on musicals in this way. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong. I haven't done enough research.
I think
there,
it is. But yeah. I think it's, from what I can gather, it's the first Broadway musical to send up musical theater, at least, yeah, as you said, like this.
Because in the way the producers had done it, which is after this, right? And
it's 6 months before this.
Oh,
although Urinetown did premiere in New York at the Fringe 2 years before the producers, so we'll still give the edge.
But even, you know, the producers is a different kind of animal. But yeah, I mean, that's the reason why Forbidden Broadway isn't really a thing anymore, because at that point they were the ones sending up musicals, and musicals took themselves very seriously. And when they were a comedy, they were seriously in that comedy or whatever. Yeah. And so once it started to happen constantly after Urinetown, and the producers in Spamalot especially, Shrek, it just kept happening where they commented on that they were in a musical, and that made Forbidden Broadway less funny and less funny and less funny because they were doing it on stage in so many shows.
Yeah. There's even a song in Forbidden Broadway of Spamalot. They're doing the song that goes like this. Yeah. And the joke is they do the song as written for the first half, and then they change the lyrics and like, wait a second, why are we singing the song as written? Oh, because Spamalot stole our gig.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is very true.
It is very true. Well, so the thing about Urinetown is the writing itself doesn't really spoof any specific musical. I mean, there are homages, as we mentioned, like, you know, to Vile and Les Mis and Fiddler and West Side Story, but they don't make jokes specifically about those shows. No one's like, well, it's just one day more, or
it's all in the staging, which is what's funny. Mm-hmm. It's all in having a reaction to meeting someone that is over the top. Mm-hmm. It is all in, it's not all in the waving a flag in the Les Mis section. That's where we're getting the West Side Story, the snaps.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the spoof comes. It doesn't come from like hitting it. I mean, a little bit with Lockstock, because he does talk about, well, in a musical, this happens. But it still doesn't feel quite like we're commenting on specific musical theater moments.
Yeah.
No, not in the staging.
Lockstock talks about Lockstock's. So like what makes it so brilliant is that when Lockstock's talking about musicals, the jokes that are given to Lockstock, rather than Lockstock making a joke, the jokes that Lockstock is given, they are always just about how musicals are constructed, how they work. So, for example, when Little Sally says we don't talk about hydraulics, you know, with this water shortage, you think we would talk about like laundry, bathing, things like that. Like, why aren't we talking about that? And so Officer Lockstock says, well, sometimes, you know, how do I best describe this? Sometimes in a musical, it's best to focus on one big thing than a bunch of little things. It helps the audience focus and it's easier to write. And I mean,
almost the line verbatim. I have it open to that page.
I am insane. I'm a freak of nature. I hate myself.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about your brain and your future partners.
What future partners? So the thing is that it's less funny if he's like, you see, Little Sally, sometimes in a musical, when you're in 19th century France and everyone's poor and on a turntable, like that's not as funny. It would be funny in the moment, but like he's just talking about the economics of musical theater, the economic storytelling, all the structure, the tropes, the format, all of that stuff. And it's funny because it's true. And we know it's true because we watch Urinetown adhere to it. Mm-hmm. So, and adhere to it really well. So we can't blame them for being smug because they are doing everything that they are calling out and they're doing it very well. It's just a very intelligent commentary, as opposed to, as you were saying, you know, like with Spamalot or with Shrek, where they'll do a moment that's like very specific to a very specific musical, or like with Something Rotten, the whole like it's a musical number, which everyone was so up in arms about. You know, I saw Something Rotten twice, about 9 months apart, and when I saw it in previews, I thought it was quite funny, and then 9 months in I saw it again and I was like, oh, this doesn't hold up as well for me because all the jokes are just, you know, name dropping: Cats, Chess, Les Miserables, A Chorus Line. And once the surprise of what the next show they're going to name drop is gone, it's less funny. Whereas Urinetown, it's all part of the structure. It's embedded into the story and the characters, which is really, really hard to do.
It's pretty genius. And I was just talking to a friend about it last night. They're like, why hasn't there been a big revival of this show? And I just think it was so specific to what it was. I think it has to remain really small. I don't know if there's an interpretation that that will top what it originally was.
Yeah.
You know, and it's such a commentary on this musical that it's weird to all of a sudden do something different and have like a huge cast or a huge set or do something really strange with it. It's sort of like when you hit it right the first time, I don't know how desperate it's up for a new you're in town interpretation unless we do it in like a bathroom in Central Park, you know?
Yeah. Site specific or something. It's, yeah, it is the double-edged sort of when the original production really just gets it completely and hits everything hard. All we could really do is put up that production again with a right cast. The only thing I can think of is like Jennifer Simard as Pennywise. I think that would be great casting. I can't think of anyone else though. Which I don't know what that says about the state of musical theater Broadway.
Maybe
we
could think of people we sat down for a minute.
Sure. It's really late in March. It's late. We've been talking for a while. Mark's got someplace to be later on.
I mean, I'm sure Michaela Diamond, my girl, she'll be the greatest hope you've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, she would be good.
See?
Yeah.
And then you just find another young, good looking, amazingly talented man.
I'm sitting right here. You don't need to keep saying all the things about me. I'm right here.
And then, maybe Charles Shaughnessy as Cladwell.
Bring him back. Bring him back. Now, at this point, Tom Cavanaugh comes back as Cladwell.
Oh my God, that's great.
We do it right this time.
Colin Hanks. Oh, I get Tom Cavanaugh and Colin Hanks very confused currently. They are the new John McMartin other
John Cullum.
John Cullum.
Which is the white man version of Cheetah Rivera, Rita Moreno.
Sure.
I would like you to do the Forbidden Broadway Cheetah is Cheetah, not Rita number, but it's about John Cullum and John McMartin.
I would.
Cullum is Cullum, not McMartin.
We'll call it the nichest thing anyone's ever seen.
Yeah. Niche? Me? You don't say. So the show opens soon after. They were supposed to open, I think, the like day after 9/11, and they ended up pushing it back a week.
The 13th was their opening.
Yeah. And then they pushed it back, I think, to the 20th. And they were able to figure it out. All the reviews were positive, but they all were saying, like, I don't know if this is the show New York needs right now, which is, and you contrast that to Mamma Mia's reviews like 2 weeks later, where everyone's like, this is so stupid, but it's exactly what everyone needs. So, like, yeah. Both shows got good reviews, but Mamma Mia really got more effusive praise because everyone was like, oh, thank God I have mac and cheese on a stage right now. And so Mamma Mia became like the big, big hit. But You're in Town was able to actually like
Millie did great that season too. I mean,
yeah,
ran to have three hit musicals in a season is like unheard of.
And made its money back, something Millie I don't think was able to do until it went out on the road. And You're in Town probably would have run longer. You know why they closed, right?
No, something with Henry Miller, right?
Yeah, was that the Henry Miller? The building above them was getting torn down.
Yes.
And they had to vacate.
Which is now the Sondheim Theater.
Yes, it is.
You can go see Anne and Juliet there. But that was the Henry Miller, the original home of the revival of Cabaret and mm-hmm. this production of You're in Town.
Yep.
I do remember that now. And they were thinking of transferring and then they just kind of closed her out.
Yeah. Well, because, transfers are expensive and they basically
exhausted.
Said,
it wasn't like it was an impossible to get into show.
Yeah. They through smart producing and budgeting, they were able to make a profit, but they'd never had a consecutive number of weeks where they were totally sold out. They had like some really amazing weeks where they were averaging like 95% capacity, and then they have a week where they were at 70, and they were able to do fine with that. But yeah, it was never an impossible ticket. And so they were like, we cannot afford to shut down for a month, move to a new theater and like keep the momentum going. It's costly. And we just recouped, like, let's just close this while it's made money. And that's exactly what they did. They did lose musical to Millie, but they did win score, book and director, which I think it might be the only musical.
I think you're right. I think it's the only musical to win. I think there might be one other. Oh, Parade too. Best book, best score.
There are shows that have won score and book, but not musical, but not score, book and director. Parade did not win director.
No Yeah, so I guess this is maybe it. Score, yeah. Book, director, but score and book is still crazy to win score and book and not win musical is crazy. In the same way, it was the Aida season to be nominated for best book, best musical, and not even get a nomination for best score, best book, but not get a nomination for best musical is insanity.
Yeah. Yeah, same thing with Legally Blonde. It's like, you liked the writing, you didn't like the show. The thing with the Urinetown wins, it's like, you could argue possibly. Sometimes when you get to musical, it's like the parts are, the whole is greater than the parts or whatever. Sometimes that's how like a jukebox musical like Jersey Boys wins, or how something like Crazy for You wins when, you know, it's got a recycled score, or Spamalot ends up winning, even though, because, you know, Spelling Bee and Piazza split the writing awards. But for You're in Town to win for both elements of its writing and for its direction. So it's like, not only do you like the material, you like how it all came together with the direction, but you ultimately gave it to Millie. It was a very political thing, obviously, because as you mentioned, like, you know, Mamma Mia was definitely the runaway feel-good hit of the season, but the Tonys couldn't bring themselves to vote for Mamma Mia.
Might go there, yes.
Yeah, so like, we'll go for the show that's a love letter to New York City that also happens to be feel-good. And we won't reward it for its writing, because its writing is fine, but not as good as You're in Town. And Millie also got a lot of flack for having half an original score. The other half was stuff from the movie and then standards that they incorporated, which is very impressive. I always thought that that score was impressive based on how it all sounded like one whole unit. But yeah, that's it on You're in Town. That's all she wrote.
There's no wait, how do we close it out?
Well, so here, Hail Malthus. Thank you and good night.
Yes.
What was your favorite joke in the show, you said?
Mine is, in this darkness, you can't see me at all.
Yeah, it's a great one. Anything Lock, Stock, and Sally have together after Follow Your Heart, when we see them up in the catwalk, and little Sally goes, she loves him, doesn't she, offers her Lock, Stock? And he goes, of course she does, little Sally. He's the hero of the show. She has to love him. It's like, he gets so moved by the love story, but also commenting on, she's got to love him. He's the lead. I love those. Yeah, I love those jokes, faxing and copying. I also love your father mentioned the size of your heart, Ms. Cladwell, but he failed to mention the size of your beauty. Does beauty have a size officer in some countries? You're a good girl, Hope. I was one too before I met your father. A good girl? You heard me. Oh, also, Adam Elsbury would be remiss if I didn't quote this one. When Hope eventually takes over in Act 2 and she shows up in Cladwell's office and surprises him and the senator, Cladwell and his assistant. And his assistant goes, Ms. Cladwell, what an unexpected surprise. And she goes, is there any other kind?
Dun, dun, dun. So good.
So good. We have a new game here, Mark.
Ooh.
Speaking of my restraining orders. Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine Tesori, and 6 Degrees of Sally Murphy. They're both the same game. They're both just 6 degrees.
Great.
We have to get 6 degrees to Janine Tesori from Urine Town and 6 degrees to Sally Murphy from Urine Town. I could do Sally Murphy if you want to do Janine Tesori.
Oh, God. I can. Do you get to do Sally Murphy while I think about Janine Tesori?
Sure. Well, Sally Murphy is going to be easy. Jeff McCarthy is in Urine Town. Jeff McCarthy was in Sideshow with Norm Lewis, who was in Wild Party with Sally Murphy.
Don't you have to do it in six?
You have to do it in six or less. You have to do it in six or less. Six is your max.
Great. Jennifer Laura Thompson was in Urine Town, obviously. And she was in, I haven't really thought any of this out. I'm just going to go with it.
Go ahead.
She was in, I can't, this is a lot to think about because I want to get it right.
I know.
All right, you do it.
I just thought of it. Jennifer Laura Thompson is in Urine Town. She was in Dear Evan Hansen with Michael Park, who was the original Flick.
Violet, written
Monty,
by
sorry, no, the original Monty. Monty in Violet.
Yes. Oh, yeah, he's not Flick.
Flick
he's
is
Monty.
Yeah, Monty. The original Monty in Violet.
Michael McElroy. And then how do you get to Michael McElroy? Yes, that's good. See, not that hard to do.
Yeah. And then Michael McElroy in Wild Party with Sally Murphy.
And Lee Hawking.
And Lee Hawking, yeah. Michael McElroy, he's the other brother, right?
He's the brother.
Oh, God. Talk about another amazing original cast.
Oh, God, I love that Wild Party.
We've talked about this. This is why we're soulmates, bitch.
I know. I love it. It's so good. If you don't know the real Wild Party, give it a listen.
Hashtag my Wild Party. So as Mark knows, we close out every episode with a diva. We already decided 9 years ago, Jennifer Laura Thompson. Mark, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
You can find me waiting for Jennifer Laura Thompson at the stage door. No, you'll never find me one at a stage door ever. Okay. You can follow me at Mark Tumminelli, T-U-M-M-I-N-E-L-L-I, over at Instagram. And you could listen to me talk to other people on the Little Me Podcast. And that's just, you can also follow us at Little Me Podcast on Instagram. And you can, if you have a kid who likes to sing, dance, or act, you can send them to Broadway Workshop and visit BroadwayWorkshop.com. And that's my company. And if you're hiring a director for anything, you can email me at my first name dot my last name at gmail.com.
Brilliant. You want to follow me, just go to Instagram, Matt Koplik, usual spelling. It's mostly just my reviews these days, and then occasionally promoting the podcast, but I'll try to come up with some extra original content for y'all. If you like the podcast...
Nudes, nudies.
That's all the world wants is my needs. If you like the podcast, 5-star rating, please and thank you. Some nice new reviews would be glorious. The algorithm is a bitch and we're a slave to it. The good Lord made us so we'd adhere to an algorithm.
Please.
And join us next week for I don't know what, because we're doing this whole thing out of order and scheduling and recording this thing has been a monster, and I have 4 episodes lined up recording. I don't know in what order, so I don't know what's the next episode.
So just buckle up, everyone. You never know what's coming.
Yeah, it could be a play, could be a musical. If it's a play,
but you definitely want to hear about it.
Yeah, you want to hear about Proof or Top Dog Underdog?
Me personally?
No, not you. I don't care what you think or care about.
I love Proof. Good play.
It is a good play. No, she'll be talked about. Proof will be talked about. Is it Proof or Doubt? One of the two. I can't remember which. It's either Proof or Doubt.
I saw a legendary performance of Doubt.
Legendary performance?
Yeah, Cherry Jones called for line 3 separate times.
Shut the front door.
In the middle of the summer after she won the Tony. It was like way into the run. And they had to bring her the pages of the script on stage. And she did. She said, ladies and gentlemen, if I can please use these pages, I can get through the rest of the scene. And she did it. And then she came back like nothing happened in the next scene. It was wild.
That is an amazing story.
I'll never forget as long as I live.
I wish. I saw Elaine Stritch in Night Music twice and she didn't forget her lines either time. She was wonderful, but I was like, what I would give to be at a performance where Elaine Stritch called for line. That'd be great.
She apparently used to say, Bernadette, like, she didn't know what line. She's like, you're so cute.
Yeah, they apparently had to coach the Fredericas how
to be ready to say all the important lines.
Yeah, to be like, yes, grandmother, the summer night does smile 3 times. And now let us go off stage.
And now let us exit. God bless. God bless you. God bless Elaine Stritch. God bless your listeners. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. God bless us each and everyone. God bless John Cullum, John McMartin. And once again, everyone, thank you so much for making it this far and listening. Join us next week for God Knows What. And in the meanwhile, here's a little JLT for you. Take us away, JLT. Bye.
Somewhere after midnight in my wildest fantasy. Somewhere just beyond my reach, there's someone reaching back.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.